leave, he could survive on his own. It wasn't his job to save this German woman from the demons of her past. There simply wasn't time for attachment or sentimentality. He lay back as she began to speak. The wind died outside and darkness fell. The room filled with golden light from the oil lamp burning on the table. He stared out into nothing, as if the past were all around her, and she had only to reach out to touch it. Berlin was the capital, and where Hitler resided, but it was a city he never liked. Munich was Hitler's heartland. He often spoke of his boundless love for the place where he'd arrived as a penniless artist, sketching picture postcards to sell on the street. This was where the National Socialist Revolution had begun, with the unsuccessful beer hall putsch in 1923, where the bodies of the men who died that day were encased in massive stone sarcophagi, guarded by granite-faced SS men in black uniforms. Munich was where Hitler had found his first supporters, disenfranchised soldiers, rejects, and cast-offs of a society scarred by war. In those early days, they marched in step dressed in coats and windbreakers, not able to afford uniforms. His followers multiplied until he was known as the King of Munich just a few short years after his arrival. It was something Hitler never forgot. Munich was his. The Nazi takeover had tempered the luminosity and charm of Munich by 1941. There was even less escape from the ubiquitous Nazi flags than in Freiburg. The Nazi bully boys controlled the city, as they did everywhere in Germany now, and the lack of freedom felt like a vice. But the Nazis could not snuff out all life and beauty from this vibrant place. Franke found refuge in the arts and attended concerts regularly. She found the ultimate escape in music, and that in itself was a protest. Music gave life to the part of her that the Nazis could never touch. She found peace in this subtle form of protest, for to declare an interest in the arts was to be anti-Nazi without declaring it. Hitler scorned the intellectual and the pursuit of the aesthetic. Showing love for such things was a sign of weakness, not the iron-willed toughness that the National Socialists demanded. The concert hall offered a sanctuary, and Franke felt at one with the others in the seats as the ambrosia of sound swept over her. The hospital where she worked was filled with joy and dread, horror and beauty. The soldiers from the front filled the beds, their wounds a glimpse into a hell she could never have envisioned before the war. Young boys lay broken all around her, their futures stubbed out by bullets and bombs, their eyes or legs missing, their faces burned to cinder, their lifeblood leaking onto the marble floors. So much waste. She sat with boys whose only wish was that she hold their hands and smile. They showed her pictures of wives and girlfriends who'd come to visit with flowers in their hands and wet eyes. Going from bed to bed, being there for them, imbued her with a happiness she'd thought impossible. Those soldiers lit a candle in the darkness inside her. Sometimes they spoke of the Reich and their hopes for the future once the final great victory was won. Through broken teeth and torn lips, they spoke of magnificent glory on the battlefield. Their loyalty to the regime that had destroyed them was unwavering. So few of them realized they had been chewed up and spat out in the service of a lie. Few seemed to recognize the vilification that lay in wait for them once the history was written. They remained convinced that they were doing right, even at the end. She didn't have the heart to tell them any different. Nothing could have been crueler. Hans Scholl wore the gray uniform of the Wehrmacht, but with a lively charisma that was all too rare in those days. He was a year younger than she, with dark blonde hair and a face that could have graced the movies he loved. The other nurses nudged each other to look up as he strutted past. He was a student medic, taking classes at the university. He didn't use the Nazi salute, instead proffering a handshake. He asked her out 30 seconds after meeting her. She was powerless in the face of his charm, and gave an almost immediate yes. They went to a concert together the next night. He held her hand as Beethoven's Fifth Symphony boomed, and she knew he was different. She knew he was like her. The moon shone bright over the city that night, and they sat in the park after the concert, sipping red wine in the warm summer air. It was almost enough to forget. Hans made her laugh, made her feel beautiful. His eyes sparkled in the silver light. Tyranny and terror were forgotten. The barbs of the past melted away, and she knew something had begun. He was from Ulm, a small town she remembered visiting as a child, 100 miles from Munich. He spoke about his family often. His father was a local politician and business owner, as well as an ardent critic of the Nazi Party, and had been arrested by the Gestapo for seditious thinking. He often mentioned his siblings, especially his little sister, Sophie, who was to follow him on to the university the year after. He was a former member of the Hitler Youth. He should have been one of the bright lights in the movement, yet he wore no Nazi pin, and spoke about the government evasively, always eager to change the subject. Instead, he told stories he'd heard from his fellow soldiers who'd served in Poland. He talked about civil liberties and freedom with a passion and vehemence that left her in no doubt as to where his allegiances lay. There was a liberty in being with him. He was someone she could discuss art and politics with, and who agreed with her that the machinations of the National Socialist regime would ultimately lead to the destruction of the German nation. Some of the other nurses stopped talking to her when it became public knowledge that they were together. At the end of the summer of 1941, Hans invited her to a gathering of a group of his friends. Ostensibly, he said, they were meeting to discuss philosophy. In reality, they met to vent their political frustrations. The gathering took place not at a bar, but in the study of a private home. Cups of coffee and glasses of beer lay on the table, along with stacks of papers and books. Hans introduced Franka to his friends Willy and Christoph, and she sat around the table with a handful of others. All were students and younger than she, except for the owner of the house, Dr. Schmarell, whose son, Alex, sat beside him. After brief introductions, Hans began to talk. "We've all heard stories from the front. Franka and I see the German victims of this useless war every day in the hospital." The men glanced over at Franka before fixing back on Hans. "I heard just yesterday from a trusted friend, who saw with his own eyes the sight of Poles and Russians being herded into concentration camps on the Eastern Front, to be executed, or worked to death providing slave labor." The feeling of escape was overwhelming, almost giddying. Franka hadn't heard anyone speak like that, other than her father. Not even Hans had been this frank with her before. A fire had been set within her. "Girls were rounded up," Willy said, "and sent to whorehouses to service their new SS masters against their will. It's more than the mere subjugation of a people. It's rape and murder on an industrial scale. It's horror that mankind has hardly known before, and it's being perpetrated in all our names." Christoph stood up. "The treatment of the people in the occupied territories is an abomination, even more so than the regime's treatment of its own citizens. The question is, do we act? Can we sit back and watch this happen? It's all well and good sitting around this table, voicing ideas that, if known outside, would land us all in jail." He turned to Franka, who felt the spotlight glare on her. Franka, Hans has told us what the Nazis did to your brother. You've suffered terribly at their hands.
All waited for her to speak, but the words caught in her throat. She'd only told Hans of what had happened to Freddy in stuttering sentences, hadn't revealed the depth of the pain behind it, and she wasn't ready to share with these strangers, like-minded though they were.
I'm not ready to speak about that here and now, but suffice to say that the Nazis have destroyed, or attempted to destroy, all that was once virtuous and true in this wonderful country of ours. And you ask, should we do something? My unequivocal answer is yes. It is our moral duty.
But what can we do? Willy said. If it's our moral obligation to do something as loyal Germans, then what? The scope of the military is certainly beyond us. We're not assassins or rabble-rousers. We're not military strongmen or bullies like the Nazis themselves. We use our strengths, Hans said. We channel our ideas onto paper, and we spread the truth as we see it. The Nazis are quick to proclaim their might and the fact that the empire they're building will last 1,000 years. But they're so afraid of their own people that they suppress with terminal effect any denunciation. They're terrified of one thing, the truth. If we can spread the truth among the people about the horrors the Nazis perpetrate in their name, we will win. The Jews left in our cities are marked with a golden star. But where are the others? We know now. We know, but most people don't or pretend not to. If we can force the German people to face up to the truth, we have a chance of real and sustained change. We must be the conscience of Germany. We must speak for the Jews, the homosexuals, the clergy, and the other enemies of the state who have disappeared. We need to let our people and the rest of the world know that there are Germans who are appalled at the actions of the Nazis and demand that they desist.
The political discourse lasted a few more hours until, exhausted, Franka went home. The words she'd heard at the meeting buzzed around inside her head for days, drowning out the Nazi propaganda that would have otherwise dominated her daily life. The steps to turning these words into actions took time. In the Nazi state, the necessities of their mission, such as typewriters, paper, and a duplicating machine, were hard to come by without drawing suspicion. Hans procured a location to house the tools they acquired, and they began to work out an outline for their leaflets. They came up with basic arguments, which were smoothed out and sharpened at their regular meetings. They called themselves the White Rose, and their first mail drop was scheduled for a few months later, for that summer of 1942. There were no set rules or regulations for meetings or membership of the White Rose. No members' list was formalized, and no one was sworn to secrecy or forced to place their hand on a Bible as they joined. It was understood that Hans was the driver of the organization and, as such, made the decisions about what direction the group was going. New members joined, always vetted by the existing ones, more on feeling than anything else. A Gestapo mole would mean arrest and prison, or worse, for all of them. The yoke of the Nazi state hung heavy on them, yet they laughed and had fun. They were still young. None of the activities of the White Rose focused on the university, where most of them were enrolled. The group was an island in an ocean of Nazi loyalists, and they refused to take part in the university's activities, all of which were sponsored or approved by the National Socialists. Franka and Hans spent all their free time together now. There was more to their lives, more to their relationship, than the politics of the White Rose. There was still time to be young and in love, even as Germany sank deeper into the abyss. In April 1942, weeks before the first mail drop, Franka and Hans walked hand in hand along the banks of the river. Other couples strolled past them. Some were teenagers. Some were married couples with children, scampering along in front of them. but none seemed fundamentally different from Franka and Hans. They passed an elderly couple sitting on a bench and staring out at the setting sun with contented looks on their withered faces.
Do you think we'll be sitting there together in 50 years?
She passed the words off as a joke, though the question behind them was quite deliberate.
Of course,
he replied.
I could never imagine wanting to be with anyone else.
She was just about to say something when he spoke again.
In a way, I'm jealous of other couples. They seem to be oblivious to the horrors around them. I can imagine there is some bliss in being able to remove yourself like that.
You could never do that, Hans. It's not who you are. That's part of the reason I love you so much.
That and my incredible good looks, right?
I didn't want to say that first. I didn't want to seem shallow.
Too late. I know now.
You're different when we're alone,
she said.
Lighter, somehow.
You see the real me, Franka. The person I want to be all the time.
He looked around to make sure no one could hear them before he continued.
You see the person that I'll be for the rest of my life, once the scourge of the National Socialist regime has been vanquished for good. That's all I want, to live a quiet, simple life, where I can be myself, with you.
She believed him. She believed every word he said. The leaflet was around 800 words. Franka spent her time poring over it like a starving person wolfing down food. Franka's eyes clung to the third sentence, which read,
Who among us can imagine the degree of shame that will come upon us and upon our children when the veil falls from our faces and the awful crimes that infinitely exceed any human measure are exposed to the light of day?
It urged all those who adhered to German Christian tradition to
offer passive resistance. Resistance, wherever you may be. Prevent the continuation of this atheistic war machine before it is too late.
The page ended with a poem of freedom, followed by directions to pass it on and to copy it as many times as possible. Across the top, the heading read, Leaflets of the White Rose. It was Franka's job to distribute a portion of the thousands they printed. She took a train back to Freiburg, the seditious papers in her case. The leaflets were enough to have her executed. Nerves replaced the usual joy she felt on her trips home. But the train ride went without a hitch. Once back in Freiburg, she mailed the flyers to the list of addresses she carried. The mail from Munich was just as good, but the authorities wouldn't be able to pinpoint where the White Rose was from if the letters were sent from Freiburg, Berlin, Hamburg, Cologne, and Vienna. Franka returned triumphantly a few days later. No one was caught. Another leaflet followed, and then two more. They followed the same protocol, took the same precautions. Thousands of leaflets of the White Rose scattered across Germany. The authorities didn't recognize their effect, but soon she began to hear whispers on the university campus and beyond. People were talking about the White Rose essays. The conversation that the members craved had begun. The typewritten sheets were passed hand to hand, leaving excitement and disquiet in their wake wherever they went. The readers were astonished by their content. Some people met the leaflets with disgust, others amazement or disbelief. A ripple spread from Munich across the country. More than one person went to the Gestapo. After all, it was best to report things such as this straight away. No sense letting someone else take credit for reporting such seditious words. The Gestapo began the search for the originators of the leaflets. But the members of the White Rose remained untouched. Hans was determined that this was only the beginning. Franka had first met Hans's little sister Sophie after she enrolled in the university in May 1942. She came to live with him. It was awkward at first. Franco had grown used to a certain level of intimacy, which, having Hans's little sister there, interrupted at times. But she was sweet and kind, if a little serious. Hans had never spoken of her joining the group. He thought it best to hide his illegal activities from her, but it wasn't long before she came across some of the leaflets hidden in the apartment they shared. She demanded he let her join. Franca helped convince Hans. She felt emboldened by Sophie's courage and by her clear-headed determination to stand for what she thought was right. It was infectious. Any refusal would have been futile, and Hans gave in after a few days of fighting. Within weeks, she had become Hans's equal in spearheading the group. She took over completely while he, Alex, and Vili were sent to the Russian front with their units at the end of that summer. Franca continued working in the hospital, her secret life as a seditious traitor hidden from all but her closest confidants. Doubt and suspicion overtook her relationships with her colleagues and casual friends. She examined every word they said, every gesture they made. No one could be trusted. And within this isolation, Franca felt the lack of Hans in her life even more. Her regular letters, coded and repressed as they were, referred to their work with the White Rose as the Building Project. There was much to tell him. The writing and publication of the White Rose leaflets had gone into hiatus pending their return, but still the activity continued in the background. A Hamburg branch of the White Rose had been founded to help distribute the leaflets. She closed every letter to Hans with a paragraph only about her, only about them. No matter what else, she wanted him to know she thought of him every hour of every day, and was counting down until his safe return. There were some things she knew the Nazis wouldn't censor in the letters to soldiers at the front. Her father didn't return to the cabin that summer. The heartbreak was too much for him. He came to Munich at Christmas, a pale reflection of the man he'd been before the National Socialists had broken him. His job in the factory had been given to a local Nazi, half his age. He had been demoted and was considering early retirement. Father and daughter met on the platform of the train station. His face was unshaven, his skin sallow, and he smelled of whiskey. They went to dinner but spoke little, afraid of what the other might say. They went for long walks in the city, passing the rubble of the bombed-out buildings that were becoming more and more common, and past the air raid shelters that were being constructed all over. They spoke about the old days, the golden times in the cabin, and her mother. That was all. They barely mentioned Freddy's name. It would have been too painful. It had already drained so much from them. They had no more left to give. She left her father at the train station late at night on that Sunday in January. The tears came again as she hugged him.
"Will you be all right?"
she asked, as she drew back.
"Of course," he said,
but his eyes spoke a different truth.
"Would you consider moving here?"
"No, thank you. I'll stay in Freiburg, where my work is, where your mother and brother are. I still visit her grave most days. I only wish I had somewhere to go to visit him. We'll never know what those animals did with his body."
Her father broke down on the platform, the tears gushing down his face. She offered to stay with him, to come back to Freiburg for a while, asked again if he'd stay, but he refused. They sat on a bench, waiting for the train, holding one another until the train finally arrived and she said goodbye. When Hans came home from the Russian front, he was more determined than ever to spread the ideas of the White Rose. In his time as a medic on the front, he had witnessed how the German soldiers had been stripped of any chivalry, mercy, or humanity. The career army officers, who had once followed a strict code of honor, now fully subscribed to the Nazi racial dogma that drove the Wehrmacht and the SS forces alike. The war on the Eastern Front was sold as a defensive crusade against communism. But, Hans told her, it was actually a ploy to provide the living space that Hitler had promised the German people. The real crusade was against the Jews. Hans had spoken to dozens of soldiers who had witnessed the mass murder of thousands of Jewish civilians, lined up along the edge of mass pits that would become their graves. He was changed by what he'd seen. Franka held him as he lay shaking in bed on the first night he returned. The newspapers were full of stories of heroic victories against the communist hordes on the Eastern Front. The Russians were portrayed in caricature as beasts, dismissed as uneducated subhumans, unworthy of existence. Only the Jews were a lower form of life. Only they more beastly, more inferior to the Russians, whom the dashing Aryan soldiers would vanquish with ease. The Battle of Stalingrad changed perceptions that the Nazis were invincible. The members of the White Rose took careful note. Hitler refused to give the order to let his men retreat, condemning them to death in a frozen city over 1,000 miles from home. The German Sixth Army was wiped out. The official reports held that the hundreds of thousands who died were heroes, and stated that their sacrifice would lead the Reich onto greater victories to come. The members of the White Rose knew better. They knew that Nazi victory was no longer inevitable, and that for the first time, Germany was looking defeat square in her cold grey eyes. Hitler had tasted his first major loss. The White Rose wasn't going to pass up such an opportunity. Stories of the regime cracking down on any defiance, no matter how inconsequential, littered the newspapers. A man was put to death for stating that Hitler should be murdered for allowing so many German soldiers to die. The Gestapo beheaded a waiter for making fun of the Führer, and executed a businessman for daring to state out loud that the war was going badly for Germany. In Berlin, 50 people were executed for transmitting sensitive information to the Russians in what became known as the Red Orchestra affair. The men involved were not executed by guillotine, the official method of the Nazi executioners. They were hung on meat hooks and left to die in agony. The women, who were sentenced by the court to life in prison, were executed by guillotine on Hitler's personal orders. Franka knew several people arrested by the Gestapo for careless words or writing the wrong thing in letters. The Nazi grip on Germany was tightening, even as it entered its death throes. Somehow, the White Rose managed to avoid the sprawling tentacles of the Gestapo. But they all felt the pressure of what they were doing. Franka felt the fear of arrest in everything she did now. They all did. But it only made them more determined to press on. There was no talk of backing down. That would have meant giving in. They wrote and printed more leaflets. Franka played her part once more. She read through the latest paper as she sat in the bathroom on the train to Cologne to distribute the latest set of flyers.
"We will not be silent," the leaflets read. "We are your bad conscience. We will not leave you in peace."
Thousands were mailed all over Germany. The excitement she'd once felt was usurped by terror at the thought of her capture. Surely it was a matter of time. It was a question of who would capitulate first, the White Rose or the regime itself. The tides of war were turning against the Nazis. Stalingrad and the defeat since had proved as much, but the Gestapo was as formidable as it had ever been. Thoughts of leaving the group had been germinating inside her for weeks. They began to sprout. She made up her mind on the train back to Munich to take a break, to go away for a while, and to convince Hans and Sophie to do the same. They were operating with an abandon that would lead to their deaths. Nothing else seemed logical. Telling them was going to be the hard part. Hans and some of the others had begun a graffiti campaign on the walls of the University of Munich, daubing anti-Hitler slogans in tar on the walls and roads of the old university. They were going too far. It was February 1943. The Allied bombers had taken the night off from their relentless pounding. Franke stole down the street in the darkness, came to the studio where they printed the forbidden leaflets. She gave the secret knock. Lily answered the door and greeted her with a kiss on the cheek. Sophie sat at a desk in the corner writing. Hans was operating the stencil machine, his sleeves rolled up, his face red and sweating.
"Can I speak to you, Hans?"
He nodded and gestured to Alex to take over. Franke led him into the back room, where they sat down.
"I want you to stop,"
she said.
"What are you talking about?"
"The Gestapo is closing in, and you know it. They're asking questions all over the university. They know we're based here. It's only a matter of time before they find us. Perhaps it's time to stop while we're all still alive. You are no use to the resistance if you're dead."
His hand was shaking as he picked up his coffee mug.
"We can't stop. Not now that we have the nation's attention. Perhaps the Gestapo is getting closer, but that only raises the stakes. We have a platform that we must use while we can. No one has ever had the chance to do what we're doing. We can't waste that. That's exactly what the Nazis want."
"Everyone admires what you've done."
"What we've all done. We've all played our part. You included, Franke."
"Of course. Thank you. I'm proud to have been a part of this, in some small way. But what can we achieve if we're dead or in jail?"
"You don't think I know the risks? A child knows that anyone who speaks out against the regime is dead. But does that not necessitate our work even more? Does that not inflate the importance of what we're doing? We're the only people spreading ideas of freedom in a country that needs them more than any other. We're giving bread to the starving minds of the masses. If we disappear, then so does the dream of a better nation."
"Do you really think that you can bring down the most powerful regime in Europe with a few leaflets?"
"Do you appreciate anything we've been trying to do here?"
"Of course I do."
"I don't think that we can change anything alone. We can only change if the entire German nation stands with us against the Nazis. That's what this is about. That's what this has always been about, spreading the idea of freedom and planting the seeds of truth in people's minds."
"I don't want to see you die, Hans. I love you."
"And I love you, Franke. But this is bigger than us. We're creating a dissonance that has the power to challenge the greatest evil ever to befall our country, or maybe even the world."
"Can't you just stop for a while?"
"Not now. Perhaps the Gestapo is closing in, and perhaps I will die soon. But history will not judge me kindly if I don't take this opportunity we've been given. And how could I leave my sister to do this alone anyway? You've seen her. If anything, she's more passionate about this than I am. There's only one way for me, and for the White Rose, and that's forward."
"It seems that nothing I can say will change your mind."
His bloodshot eyes remained unmoved.
"Just promise me you'll be careful."
He stood up to embrace her. She held him against her and kissed him one last time. He walked her to the door as the others said goodnight, and then he closed it behind her. Hans and Sophie were arrested at the University of Munich on February the 18th, 1943. A handyman, empowered by the Nazis, and in his spare time a goose-stepping stormtrooper, saw them tossing leaflets over the balcony like confetti. He had been briefed by the Gestapo to watch for any suspicious behavior, even more so than usual. It must have seemed like the best day of his life when he saw the two students tossing the forbidden flyers off the balcony. He arrested them himself, doubtless excited about his upcoming promotion and the cash reward that awaited him. Hans and Sophie were taken from the university campus to the Gestapo headquarters at the Wittelsbach Palace, the former royal palace of the Bavarian monarchs in the center of the city. They were charged with high treason violent overthrow of the government, the destruction of National Socialism, and the defeat of their own army in wartime. Christoph was arrested a few hours later. The Gestapo found all the evidence they would ever need in their apartments, and any trial would be a sham. The news of Hans and Sophie's arrest spread throughout the university. Franca was at work that night when Willi came to tell her. She cried all night. There would be no mercy, only retribution, and it was just a matter of time before the Gestapo came for them, too. The newspapers reported the arrest of the traitorous students the next day. The editorial trusted that swift justice would follow, and so it did. Roland Freisler, the notorious chief judge of the People's Court, which only tried cases of treason and subversion, was brought down from Berlin. The trial began just 4 days later, on February the 22nd. Franca waited along with the other members, praying for some form of leniency. The trial lasted a few hours. Hans, Sophie, and Christoph were convicted and sentenced to death. They were taken from the courtroom to jail and guillotined. Christoph's wife, who was sick in the hospital at the time, didn't find out that he'd been executed until several days later. Hans and Sophie's parents, who were present at the trial, went home to Ulm after the guilty pronouncements, planning their next trip back to see their children a few days later. They were not told that their son and daughter were to be executed that very day. Franca was in her apartment when the Gestapo came for her a few weeks later. Her trial was set for April, along with several other members. The panic that had overtaken the Nazis upon the initial arrests had seemingly subsided. The Gestapo questioning she underwent was milder than she'd imagined. She realized after a few minutes that they thought she was too gentle, too pretty, and too much of a girl to have had anything to do with an organization as reprehensible as the White Rose. It seemed like the investigators had already made their minds up about her, and all she had to do was play along. They knew that Hans and Sophie were the driving forces behind the movement, and that Willi, Christoph, and Alex were the other main actors. The interrogators merely wanted Franca to corroborate the story that they'd already formulated about the group and about her role as the leader's unwilling girlfriend, the loyal Aryan girl misled by the traitorous dissidents. Her role seemed vital in the narrative the National Socialists were trying to spin to a fascinated, shocked German public. The lawyer her father hired could barely believe their luck.
"I don't think they'd go so easy on you if you weren't so pretty," he said.
"The important thing is to get out of this alive," her father said. "Say whatever you need to say to get out of this with your life. Denounce the organization. Save your skin."
Franca wanted to speak up for the cause, wanted to tell the court that she was proud of what they'd done, and that Hitler was the murderous traitor.
"How can I denounce my friends? That would mean turning my back on everything I believe in. How could I live with myself?"
"Don't do it for yourself. Do it for me. I need you now, more than ever. Don't leave me. Live on. For me."
So she did. She denounced the White Rose in front of the court, stating that she'd been led astray by the dangerous revolutionary her boyfriend had turned out to be. Her heart was ragged inside her, every denial tearing another strip away. Her father smiled at her across the courtroom, giving her the thumbs up as she declared her loyalty to the Reich. She thought of Hans and the rousing final speech in support of freedom he'd given in that same courtroom. But as her father said, he was dead now, and so was the White Rose. She didn't have to die with them. So she sold out everything she believed in to be there for him, so he wouldn't be left alone. Franca got 6 months in jail. The judge proclaimed that he hoped it would give her pause to reflect on the choice of company that she kept, and that once she got out, she should fulfill her duty in marrying a loyal servant of the Reich, preferably a soldier serving on the front, and bear him many children to serve the Führer. She cried as the bailiff led her out of the courtroom. The shame was more than she could bear. Willy, Alex, and the professor from the university they'd drawn inspiration from, Dr. Huber, were all executed also. They were the true heroes. Franker avoided the dreaded KZs, the concentration camps, which had become the unmentionable horror in Germany, the truth that even the most hardened Nazi supporters didn't want to admit to. She was sent to Stadelheim prison, along with several other former members of the White Rose, where Hans and the others had been executed. She sank into a deep depression. The ghosts of the fallen heroes of the White Rose haunted her dreams. Time passed. Her depression deepened. Her father regularly sent letters, and the promise of the next one was the only thing that kept her alive. His kind, hopeful words were the only sign of love or beauty in a world that had been stripped of such things. The letters stopped in October. Her father had been killed by a stray bomb dropped from an Allied plane. She was due to be released 3 weeks later. Her family was the victim of both sides in this useless, disgusting war. They had taken everything from her. She lingered in Munich for a week or two after her release. There was little to remember from that time. She didn't belong there anymore. She couldn't pretend to be a part of their society anymore. The flags still flew over bombed-out buildings, and the swastika still adorned the countless coffins shipped home from the Eastern Front. A letter arrived from her father's attorney in Freiburg. Her father's will was ready. No one else would be in attendance. That was when she decided that she would end her life. There was nothing left for her. It seemed fitting to go back, to do it there in her hometown, near the place she'd known the most joy. She heard the lawyer read her father's will, endured his disapproving glares under the portrait of Hitler that hung above his desk, and the next day visited her parents' graves. They lay nestled beside each other on a hill overlooking the city they'd lived in. Immediately after, she retreated to the cabin. The worst of the memories came at night, and sleeping alone was an unendurable torture. The pain became more than she could bear. She set out that night with no destination in mind, never thinking that she'd walk as far as she did. But there was always another hill to climb, another tree line to pass. And then she found him. Franka finished her story. The candle, almost burned down, flickered in the room. The night was still outside, absolutely silent. Franka, what happened to Freddy? How did he die? What did the Nazis do to him?
I can't talk about that now. I have to go.
She shut the door behind her, leaving him alone in the half-light of the bedroom. Chapter 8. It had been a week since she'd found him. The pain in his legs had reduced to a simmer now, but he was still bound to this bed, trapped in this cabin. The light of the day outside was dying, the sun tossing out bright oranges and reds that cut through the snow-dusted glass of the window in his room. He ran through Franka's story again and again, searching for inconsistencies that weren't there. He hadn't seen her since last night, since she'd walked out after telling him about her past. It had been hard not to tell her what he knew about the activities of the White Rose. He thought back to his training, to the interrogation techniques he'd learned. Her eyes betrayed a profound truth. He knew she wasn't lying, but he also knew that she was holding something back. She'd told him most of her story, but there was something else, a missing piece. Regardless, It was almost impossible to imagine she was a Gestapo agent. If she knew he wasn't German, and had reported him, he would have been in a windowless room, staring into a spotlight. She was a traitor to the cause, had served time for activities against the regime, and had escaped the guillotine only by being underestimated by the men who'd tried her. Had she somehow worked out who he was? How? He reached over for the glass of water beside his bed and took a cool drink. If she had worked out that he wasn't German, what else had she worked out? Today's weather was fine. It wasn't easy to tell through the frost-encrusted window, but it hadn't snowed. The cabin was likely accessible now. The world could encroach on their hidden place. He looked around. There was no room in the cabin for a listening place, for clandestine Gestapo men peering at him through holes in the wall. He heard everything that went on when she brought wood in, when she made herself a cup of coffee in the kitchen. He'd heard her take a bath earlier, and knew that she was reading in the rocking chair by the fire in the living room right now, as she listened to the radio. She acted with absolute abandon in front of him. She listened to illegal radio stations, and often spoke about her disdain for the regime. If he were a Luftwaffe officer, as his credentials said, then she could expect harsh treatment from the Gestapo if he reported her illegal activity. She was telling the truth when she said she knew. There was no other explanation. Somehow, she knew. A noise from the living room told him that she'd gotten out of her seat and was in the kitchen now. Her footsteps came toward his door, followed by a knock. The door opened. Her face was colorless and drawn. It was rare that he saw her during the day, unless she had a specific reason for coming into the room. She usually came only at mealtimes, but it was still at least an hour until dinner.
Are you well?
I'm quite comfortable, Fräulein. It was a discipline, a learned behavior to fight back his instincts, to not reveal himself. He had heard her bedsprings creaking through the night, and saw the rings under her eyes now. Franka, you've nothing to feel guilty about.
What?
It's not your fault you're alive and they're not, and you shouldn't feel shame for not wanting to die. The words came without thought or ulterior motive. He was surprised at himself.
I sought out the last thing I believed in.
She turned to him, her voice muted, her eyes on the floor.
I had nothing else in this life. At least, if I'd spoken out...
You'd be dead now, and so would I. What good would that have done? Who would that have served? Hans is dead, but that doesn't mean that you can't live on.
It's ridiculous. I've never revealed this much to anyone before. I don't even know you.
Confidants are hard to come by these days. Could he trust her? Was her story real? What were the chances of finding someone like her? He wanted to believe her, but he couldn't. Not while he knew she was holding something back. Franka, is it all right if I call you that?
Yes, of course.
I want to thank you for telling me your story.
Are you going to report me?
She said. For what?
For listening to banned radio stations. For making seditious claims against the Führer.
I'm not a Nazi.
Who are you, then?
Not every German in uniform is a Nazi. You should know that better than most.
And not everyone in a Nazi uniform is a German.
There is no room for questioning the government in time of war, he said, feeling the hollowness of his words.
The White Rose felt quite the opposite.
And you consider yourself a true patriot for speaking out against the government?
I did once. I'm not worthy of the name now. Not after what I did. Hans and Sophie, Willy and Alex. They were the true patriots.
Silence hung heavy in the room. This was the time. The opportunity was dangling in front of him.
There's something you're not telling me, he said.
What are you talking about?
I know people. It's part of my job. I was trained to recognize when someone is hiding something, and I see you are.
What about you, Herr Gruff?
She spat the name out as if it was sour.
What are you hiding from me?
This isn't about me.
Oh, isn't it?
He was aware of the gun under his pillow, and knew what effect reaching for it would have on this conversation, on all of this.
There's something in you that you haven't told me about.
You've told me nothing!
She shouted.
I can't divulge the details of the mission that I'm undertaking.
I know. For the good of the Reich. You reach inside me, and when I give, you only ask for more.
She stood up.
You say you're not a Nazi, but you're just like them. Maybe you're the one who's hiding something.
She made for the door and slammed it behind her, but the lock didn't catch, and it came ajar. The entire cabin quaked as she stomped to the kitchen. He heard her pull a chair up to the table, and then the sound of her weeping. He fought the weakness he felt within himself. She wept alone. What could he do stuck in this bed, in this cabin, in these mountains? Could he trust her? It was the same question, over and over in his mind, unchanging. Could she do what he couldn't now? It was true that she'd revealed much of herself, but he could tell there was something else lurking. He could feel it. What had happened to Freddy, her brother? She'd glossed over him in the story as if he'd faded into nothing. Why wasn't she visiting him, if he was in an institution nearby? It was the last part of the riddle, the final puzzle piece. Once revealed, secrets could not be unsaid, and the pistol he'd stowed under his pillow might be his only recourse. He had to be sure. Her life depended on it. Hours passed. Dinner never came. His water glass ran dry, and his chamber pot remained. He could hear her outside, could hear every footstep, but he didn't make a sound. He knew they were at a tipping point, and she had to be the one to make the next move. He waited. The cuckoo clock in the hallway chimed 11. The impenetrable black of night had turned the window into a mirror, reflecting the yellow glow of the oil lamp. The sound of her footsteps came. She stood at the door a few seconds, the light of the oil lamp dancing through her blue eyes. He didn't speak.
I'm going to tell you what you want to know, but not for you, for me,
she said. Her voice faded and dull.
I've been carrying this around with me for too long. Hans was the only person I told, but there were some details I couldn't share, even with him.
She stared off into nothing, the words tumbling out of her mouth. Freddy was almost 14 when they took him to the institution in 1939. His size was beginning to work against him. He was already almost 6 feet tall, and as his body grew, his limbs seemed to wither. The sight of him walking was a memory now, and Thomas was struggling to lift him in and out of his wheelchair each day. Franca was going to Munich to begin her new life. Her father had encouraged her to the point of almost forcing her to take the job. He insisted that she had her own life to live, and that Freddy was going to prove too much for either of them. It was best that the professionals look after him. Franca accepted her father's wishes without protesting, but deep down, she knew that it was her selfishness that was driving her away, her own wish to live a separate, independent life. She was 22. Daniel was the only love she'd ever known. She wanted more. Freiburg seemed poisoned to her now. Munich
the big city, would offer a new hope. Freddy was better than any single person she had ever known. Hatred, malice, vindictiveness, and spite, the emotions that formed the bedrock of Nazism, were beyond him. Love was all he knew. Those who knew him felt the radiance of this love. It was impossible to resist. He took with typical optimism and good grace the news that he was moving into the home, declaring that he'd have a chance to make hundreds of new friends. And so it was. When Franka came back to visit in November 1939, a few weeks after he'd moved in, it seemed as if he'd been there his whole life. Everybody knew him. Everybody loved him. And he spent almost an hour introducing her to his new friends there, from the nurses who greeted him with beaming grins, to the patients who couldn't move or talk, who greeted him with a nod or a raised hand. No one was immune to his spirit. Franka came back to visit as often as she could. She returned to Freiburg every 3 weeks or so, visiting Freddy each time with her father, whom the staff all greeted by name. Freddy seemed happy and in the best place. Her father reiterated that so often that she began to believe it, and the guilt of her moving to Munich eased. His condition stabilized. The doctors offered no hope of a cure, but the degeneration in his limbs slowed. Freddy could get around the institution with ease in his wheelchair, and he always had somewhere to be, someone to see and cheer up. Franka knew several of the nurses from her time in school, and kept in touch with them about Freddy's progress in between visits. The more time went on, the more at ease Franka and her father became. Their new life with Freddy was better than ever. Their father could relax for the first time in what seemed like many years. Franka's peace of mind over Freddy's welfare allowed her to launch into her new life with verve and passion. It seemed as if equilibrium might be possible. The news came without warning. It was April 1941, and Franka was called to the phone at work. It was one of the nurses she knew from the institution, crying as she spoke. The black SS vans came without warning on a Tuesday afternoon. It was a fine day, and all the patients, even those in catatonic states, were brought outside. The older patients who were able to stand were told to line up. The head nurse objected but was pulled away and arrested. Men in white coats, who didn't identify themselves as doctors, examined the older patients' mouths. The staff were assured that it was all routine and would soon end. The patients were put into groups, some with an ink stamp on their chests from the attendant. One group was allowed to return inside, while the other, much larger group, was herded to where the vans were parked. The patients were loaded into the vans, some in their wheelchairs, others hobbling on crutches, and some carried on stretchers. One child asked the SS commandant where they were going, and he told them they were going to heaven. They went to the vans with reassured smiles on their faces. Freddy was nervous. It was as if some instinct told him that they were lying. Freddy fought, flailing at the nurses, begging them to let him stay. Screaming nurses who tried to come to his aid were held back with a flat edge of rifles and thrown to the ground. A smiling SS man put a hand on Freddy's shoulder and told him that they'd soon return with wonderful stories to tell, and that where they were going offered free ice cream. Soothed by lies, Freddy began to calm. The same SS soldier took the handles of Freddy's wheelchair and pushed him to the black van to take his place with his friends. The SS men started the children in song, as if they were sending them on a day trip to the fair. Freddy waved as the door slammed behind him, and the sound of the children singing lilted through the air as they drove away. Franka's father made frantic inquiries as to his son's whereabouts, and was met with a wall of feigned ignorance and denial. A few agonizing days passed before he was informed by letter